never know. So welcome to this seminar, the third seminar of this year. I'm sorry to say that it's going to be a lot of PowerPoint slides today. The reason I've put in so many PowerPoint slides is that I'm going to cover a lot of things that's not in the textbook of the course. So I added quite a few examples and different tools that I would like you to know about. So that's why it's a lot of PowerPoint. But I hope you will survive. Have a lot of coffee and try to not fall asleep. So we'll start the two first hours talking about incident response planning and also go through some different organizational models for CSIRTs and SOCs. And then we move to the K105 room and we continue talking about incident response, and we go through different ways that we do detection of incidents and notifications. Also, we look at what kind of services CSIRT typically has and different tools that you can use in the incident response. So I encourage you, when I go through lots of different tools, I always provide a URL where you can check out this tool yourself. And lots of them are open source and can be downloaded, can be played around with, and I really encourage you to do that because it will give you a better understanding of what incident response work is really like. Okay, are you ready for 2 hours and then 2 hours in the next room? 4 hours together? Of course, I'll give you 15-minute breaks in between. So today, there's a lot of the learning goals. I want you to learn about how to plan for incident response and how to set up a team, how to form a security incident response team, what types of skills and what type of components you might need for this, how you establish the capabilities, and we'll look into different organizational models and different operational issues. I'll try to illustrate with some examples from my hands-on practical work for incident response. But the next seminar, where we talk about the APTs and the more advanced threats, I'll go into some details, more detailed examples. So I go through some cases in that lecture. I won't have time to go through cases in detail today. So it's going to be full overview, and of course you should just ask questions if it's something that you want to elaborate more. And after, when we move to the next room, I'll talk about the incident detection and notification, and we'll talk about intrusion detection systems and how to make decision making when you're doing talk about proactive versus reactive detection and different tools and mechanisms, threat intelligence, and data feeds, and lots of things that the incident responder is all about. Any questions before we start? Have you started doing your project work? Yes, someone is nodding. I'm still waiting to get the emails from more master students. I took a look at the list of students and I saw that I think there's at least 5 master students that I haven't heard anything from yet. And you need to send me an email with your title of your essay. Okay? I don't know if you're in the room or in the stream, or maybe see this at any time, but please send me. I'm not going to chase after you to do this work. It's your own responsibility. Okay. So, just a motivational quote before we start. So, this is the security director at an IT firm called FMI, and he said that we front load a lot of effort into protecting things. But when a breach occurs, we look around and ask, what do we do now? There's no worse time to work out your response strategy than when you respond to it. It means you have to start thinking about this before you have a big incident happen to you. So that's why I teach you about this incident response planning, and why you take this course, and maybe in the future go out and become a responder or become someone in charge of security that needs to plan for the incidents to happen. So this is the incident response life cycle. I think we've been through this briefly before. I just want to point out that this is first part of this lecture is all about the preparation. What do we do before an incident happens? And that means in the this is the other another incident response model, which is a little bit more in detail. But this is also about making the preparations. So the first thing we do, at least according to the textbook, is to form a committee or someone that's in charge of planning the response. So that's the first thing. Someone needs to do the job of planning. And then you should develop the planning policy, which means that you should make maybe a document that is the policy that gives guidelines for the management how to perform the incident response planning and what are the expectations for management and the outcome of this. Maybe also set the scope of the work and some metrics or some quantifiable ways of determining whether or not it was a success. Okay? And then you should do the business impact analysis, as we already talked about, and this should be integrated into the plans. So you should find what are the most critical parts of your organization that you want to protect and that you need to develop incident response plans for in case something goes wrong. And then decide on what type of preventive controls you want to put in place. And this is outcome both from the business impact analysis but also from risk management. You have the opportunity to put in preventive controls that might, the controls typically cost you something, but they will, in a cost-benefit analysis, in the long term they will give benefit because they will prevent losses. But this is always a management decision. What is the budget and what are you allowed to purchase or put in the company to monitor and to protect and to prevent incidents from happening. And then if you're taking this seriously, you will maybe form a computer security incident response team. This can be done in different ways. It can be a team in your company, or it can be outsourced. We're going to look at different ways of doing this, setting up this system. And then create your incident response strategies and procedures. If you have a team in place of people, they need to have some instructions on how they're going to do their work. And also a strategy for how. What is the purpose of the incident response team? How do we do the incident response? And for that purpose, you need to develop the incident response plan. And for your bachelor students, this is also part of your project work to develop an incident response plan for your fictitious company. So you can pay attention to this to help you in the project. And when you have a plan in place, it's very important that you test it, you train the personnel according to the plan, and that you perform exercises. And then in the end, your plan needs to be updated, so you need to have a feedback loop from when incidents occur. You typically have an after-action review, where you identify what went wrong, what could have been better, and so on. And then you would update your plans with the things that you found that didn't really work this time. To always have an updated and as functional as possible. Okay, so we're going to go through all the steps now in more detail. This is the overview. Of course, it's not always you need to go through all the steps. It could be that you're in a place where you already have a C-cert, and you can skip this organize the C-cert step. Or you could just look into maybe your organization and find a new way of organizing if it's not working as well as it should. So the incident response planning team, who should be part of this team? Typical members are from management, because you always need to have support from management when you do this. And in particular, the IT management, people that work in InfoSec, and then you should also get some assistance from legal, HR, and PR. The main point here is that it should be multidisciplinary. So it's not only the IT department that creates a plan for this, and then in the end, you find out, oops, we forgot about lots of legal stuff. That's not good. Because then you need to start the pattern again. So what should be in the incident response policy? You should have a purpose and objective of your incident response, the scope. Define what is an information security incident. Maybe also describe what could be the consequence in your organization. Your organizational structure, different types of roles and responsibilities should be described in the policy. And also you could optionally put in the way you are prioritizing or rating different incidents according to your severity. Performance measures is really important because that's the way that you can figure out if the plan is successful or not. And also reporting and contact forms can be handy in this. If you don't have them in the policy, you should have them somewhere and easily accessible in case something happens. It should be easy to figure out who to contact. And how do you actually define incident response? You need to separate between different types of incidents, things that can go wrong. So an adverse event, that's typically any type of unexpected activity that occurs. And it can occur a lot of times, and it's not always an incident, it's just an event. It's only an incident as soon as it actually causes damage or disruption to any of your important information assets or your resources. An incident response is the way you're supposed to respond to incidents. This is actually a set of procedure and plans that you start doing once you detect a new incident. And they are usually reactive measures. It means that incident response is happening after the incident, naturally. So there are a lot of other things you can do before an incident to prevent, but that's not part of the incident response. Just to have the terminology in place. But in the incident response plan, you should also describe processes that are not done after an incident occurs. You could start by describing that, of course, during the incident. You should describe what happens after the incident, and that's typically after action reviews and so on. You should also describe what happens before the incident, which is really not part of incident response, but it's part of preventing incidents from happening and to be prepared for something to happen. Your plan should include a trigger, the notification method, and the response time. And I think you've seen this before too, so I'm not going to go through it in detail, but this is just showing the different timelines of the different types of plans. So what could actually trigger an incident response plan? It could be a phone call or an email from a user. The network administrator might see something suspicious. You might have an intrusion detection system in place that gives you alarms. But beware, a lot of these alarms are false positives, so they're not always incident. You can review log files, and this can be done both manually, but most likely you would have some, maybe some automatic tools that go through logs for you and create alerts. Of course, you can just see that your system goes down, and that's maybe an incident or something malfunctions. It's actually anything that goes through the incident response team and is triaged that leads to actual incident escalation. That is something that will trigger the incident response plan. And these are things described in this model. That's a little bit more detailed model of incident response. Then we will come over to the incident reaction, also done the detection. And what do we do in the reaction? You will have someone that's in charge of doing the incident response. And typically there's a team leader for each particular. You can arrange this in different ways. One way of doing it is to have dedicated personnel for different types of incidents, for instance. It could also be if you have a rotating shift of incident handlers, that this is something that is rotated, so one person is team leader for one day or for a week, and so on, and then hands off the leadership of the different incidents to the next person. When I worked at NorthCert, we did this rotating shift, so we had the incident handler officer that was in charge of all the incidents per week, and then there was a handover between personnel where we reported in all the incidents, and then the next team leader took on the responsibility of following up all the incidents next week. There are no other teams that do it differently, that have maybe one person dedicated as handling different incidents, and they follow them from start to the end. Then you have to distribute the different incidents on the different people, and then you can perhaps, depending on your skills, have one specialist on DDoS, one specialist on different types of Trojans and malware, or another team that focus more on nation state actors, one team for threats from Russia, one team for threats from China, and so on. So there are different ways of doing this. And then you have the someone should be in charge of maintaining all the logs. That's a very important role to actually document everything. And then you have incident handlers that do all the different tasks. What is important is that the team leader is a senior person, has experience, and also knows how to manage people, because you need to distribute tasks to the team. And it needs to be a person that has high tolerance for stress, because it's kind of really stressful. It's not always that you can check out from work at 5 o'clock and then forget about all the incidents. Usually it's something that will be so intense in some cases that it's hard to put the stress away. So that's why this requires a typical personality, I would say. So what are the things that you do during an incident? What is the actual incident response? And that, of course, depends on the scenario. It's not one set of procedures that solves everything. But generally, in high level, we could say that the first thing is to find out what happened. Because there's always a lot of confusion in the start of an incident, and you need to analyze it in order to figure out what type of incident is this. And that's typically looking into the logs or looking into whatever alerts came from your intrusion detection system,
maybe you also need to do some quick malware analysis or forensics. Here, this time and speed is the assets, because you don't have a lot of time in the start of the incident to do really in-depth reversing or reverse engineering of code, because that takes typically a long time. But I'll go through some tools today that shows how this can be done in a quick manner. And then the next thing after you sort of know what's going on, you do have a plan for how to mitigate the damage, how to contain it, to prevent it from spreading out more in the network, for instance, if it's a virus or something like that, how to stop it. And then coordinating all the information. That's a very big part of it, in response, is sharing information, creating reports on what's happening, reporting up to higher management, and also sharing information between different teams and reaching out to different stakeholders. And this is the part of the incident response where we actually do the incident response. So you got an incident report and you start to analyze, you start to obtain information. You might need more technical assistance, you coordinate, you get more information, and this is like a circle going on until you have a resolution and you're done with the incident. And then you get over in the incident recovery phase. And that's after the incident is resolved. And this should also be planned for. It means that the incident response plan should describe how to recover from events, from different types of attack scenarios, how to protect from follow-up events. You might need to change your configurations, harden your system, patch things depending on how they got into your system. It might be 0 day that has no patch. In that case, you might need to do some workarounds or shut down some services or whatever to not get infected again, or not get the attackers into your system again. And after the incident, typically we do forensic analysis, because that's the thing that takes a much longer time than the actual incident response. So usually that's something that is kind of postponed until after the incident. Then you get a lot of information about how the attackers worked, what they did to get into your system and so on. And you use this information to prepare better for the next incident. And that's typically part of the after action review. And after action review means that you sit down, you take a meeting with all the team members that were involved in the incident, maybe also some other stakeholders, like maybe management, hired consultants, maybe some victims that you supported in the attack or in the incident, and you sit down and go through everything and you try to find learning points for the next incident. And that goes then into planning for the before the incident, into the training of your staff, and the testing of your plans. And these are different types of ways to test your incident response plan. And you could do a desk check, just means that you check all that you have all the plans and procedures in place and so on. You can do a structured walkthrough, which is more going through all your plans and checking that everything is updated and so on. Maybe also do a simulation. This could be only paper based, or it could be actually using some tools and exercising it in a sort of desktop environment. You could gather a large group of people in a room and pretend that you have an incident, and everyone should sort of go through their plans, procedure, and talk through what could happen during an incident. You could do parallel testing, which means that you have a parallel team to your operational team, so you're at the same time as you're handling real incidents with one team, you have a second team that does their a training of incidents. Or you could have full interruption, which means that you take out
all your personnel and you do training or testing. Wargaming is something that is kind of fun. Typically, teams can do if they go away for a course or training. It's sort of competition between different teams, like capture the flag competition, where you can test your skills. Maybe some of you have participated in some capture the flag events. If not, I really recommend what you do because it's a lot of fun and you can learn a lot of things. For training, there's a lot of resources to be found. Freely available or very costly and expensive courses. So we have all the different types here. ENISA, they have a lot of exercise material and training resources that are free to use. TERENA is an organization for educational teams in the, like the university and research sector. And they have a package of the training material called Transits that they typically offer, because you usually have to pay a fee to attend those trainings. FIRST, which is Forum for Incident Response Team, they have a lot of resources on their web pages, and they also have a best practice guide library. The Netherlands CERT team created something called CERT in a Box. It's kind of old now, but it was some resources that were very helpful for new CERT teams that were establishing, because you could just download the package with a lot of different tools included that you could use to set up your team tools. SAMS has a lot of well-known and courses with well of good reputation. They're quite expensive though. They also offer networks tournaments that are really fun to participate in. And I've been to some of these trainings and they've been excellent. But typically that's something your employer would have to pay for you. This is quite expensive. But there are also other local technical training courses. Some of them in the US are created by CERT CC. These are just some of the resources I would recommend to look into. As I mentioned, when I worked at North CERT, we participated in a lot of exercises and trainings that were really fun, sometimes a bit stressful, and you could learn a lot from them. I think that the most kind of important thing I learned from doing these big exercises. We were participating in exercises with NATO, with a lot of teams, and also with ENISA, with all teams in EU. That's a lot of communication. So I remember one of those exercises, we ended up in a kind of communication overload. There were so many incoming emails and notifications that the team that we had set up a part of the exercise, so we split the team in two and had half of the people working on the incidents and the other half were on the exercise. We didn't have enough people on the exercise because they just couldn't get through all the emails and all the notifications, just totally overload. So it can be a lot of complication when you have like 10, 20 plus teams trying to work together. And that's also something you can experience in real incidents if there's a lot of teams involved. I want to show you a video, if you think it's working, from one of the exercises. This is was a national exercise with the Norwegian teams that was organized by Telenor CERT. We also participated in another Telenor CERT. If you've seen this video before, it is kind of showing the highlights of this exercise. It's in Norwegian.
startskuddet for Cyberdawn har gått. Den mest omfattende kriseøvelsen i Telenor noensinne. Etter ett år og tusenvis av timer med planlegging skal rundt 130 Telenor-ansatte få bryne seg på en rekke krisesituasjoner. Fordi hendelser i cyberdomenet krever rask samhandling på tvers av bransjer og sektorer, skal Telenor øve sammen med Cyberforsvaret, Nasjonal Sikkerhetsmyndighet, politiet, Post- og Teletilsynet, Evry, DNB og Sparebank 1. Forsvarets øvelse Hovedstad foregår samtidig, og de to øvelsene vil gripe inn i hverandre i løpet av de to dagene Cyberdawn skal utspille seg. I de seks ukene fram mot øvelsen sendes det ut fiktive nyheter til de øvende deler av Telenor Norge og de andre virksomhetene som skal delta i Cyberdawn. Nyhetene danner et globalt bakteppe og trusselbilder for øvelsen, og beskriver mulige terrortrusler mot Norge både i tradisjonell form og som cyberangrep.
Cyberdawn er en krisehåndteringsøvelse som setter det med informasjonsdeling og samfunnsansvar i et større perspektiv. Vi øver ikke organisasjonen i noe vi ikke har testet er mulig på forhånd. Alt det vi tester vil for en angriper med god tid og store ressurser faktisk være mulig å gjennomføre. Derfor er vi også veldig opptatt av at mye av informasjonen som vi avdekker her, kan vi bruke til å bedre vår egen beredskap, vår egen drift og vår egen sikkerhet.
Hvis kritisk infrastruktur ikke fungerer, så får ikke bankene kommunisert seg imellom. Helseinstitusjonene får ikke kommunisert. Vi får ikke helsetjenester, vi får ikke banktjenester. Og bedriftsmarkedet i Norge vil stoppe opp. Derfor er det Telenors ansvar å være veldig, veldig forberedt på den type kriser. Og når en krise oppstår, så er det vår jobb å minimere konsekvensen av den krisen. Det er jobben vår.
Forsvaret sikrer Telenor Fornebu som et ledd i Forsvarets øvelse Hovedstad.
Telenor er jo mye mer enn en telekom-operatør. Det er jo en operatør som også server oss med tjenester til bedrifter, organisasjoner, Sky-tjenester, internett. Så når Telenor sitt system faller ned, så er det jo kritisk for samfunnet. Og det er jo dette vi trener på nå, å være en del av det som skal prøve å beskytte og hindre at Telenor-systemer faller ned.
Hvis vi ikke klarer å ta vare på personinformasjon som ligger i våre systemer, hvis vi ikke klarer å ha nettbanken vår åpen, at den rammes av tjenestenektangrep, hvis børssensitiv informasjon glipper ut av DNB-systemene, så er det klart at da er vi med å starte en prosess hvor det vil bli stilt spørsmål rundt vår måte å drive vår forretning på. Så vi vil gjøre hva vi kan vi for å sikre oss at vi på dette området her er profesjonelle.
IT-infrastruktur blir stadig viktigere for at vi skal få levert finansielle tjenester, og vår evne til å både beskytte oss og oppdage og ikke minst håndtere og respondere på hendelser, det avgjør også hvor alvorlig konsekvensen av hendelsen blir. Og da blir jo nettopp sånne øvelser som Cyberdawn så viktig, nettopp for å på en måte kunne begrense konsekvensene dersom et angrep på IT-tjenestene våre skulle finne sted.
Nasjonal Sikkerhetsmyndighet har ansvaret for å koordinere den nasjonale innsatsen mot cyberangrep.
Det er mange som kan stå bak slike angrep. Det kan være stater, det kan være konkurrenter, eller det kan være nesten hvem som helst. Og hva er det vi ser? Jo, vi ser alle kategorier representert som utgjør angriper.
Det er viktig at Post- og Teletilsynet er involvert, fordi at vi har et koordineringsansvar for hele telebransjen. Ikke bare den ene aktøren, Telenor, men alle aktørene. Og for at vi skal kunne koordinere det som skjer med regjeringens kriseråd, og for eventuelt å bruke vår myndighet til å stoppe enkelte aktører som opptrer ulovlig, så er det viktig at vi er involvert.
Vi er på full fart inn i et samfunn som er heldigitalisert og nettverksbasert, og dess mer avhengig vi blir av IKT, dess mer sårbare blir vi også. Jeg mener jo at vi har systemer i dag som er godt sikret, men det er ingenting som kan kalles 100% sikkerhet. Noen vil klare å trenge inn, og noen vil kunne klare å stoppe systemer, Og avhengig av hvilke systemer vi snakker om, så kan det selvfølgelig ha store konsekvenser, både for sektorer som sådan, men også for den enkelte innbygger. Og til syvende og sist vårt eget samfunn i Norge.
Evry forvalter og opererer en stor del av IT-infrastrukturen til Telenor.
Vi ser jo at både intensitet og hyppighet av ikke forretningsmessige trafikk på nettet, det øker. Det er både Telenor som kunde, men vi ser jo dette også for mange andre kunder som opplever det samme trusselbildet. Det å være med i øvelsen setter deg i hvert fall i stand til å få bevissthet og klarhet i det. Det å forstå hvor er det er åpninger, forstå hvor er det ting ikke henger godt nok sammen, det tror jeg er svært viktig.
Situasjonen i øvelse hovedstad har tilspisset seg. Forsvaret har informert Telenors ledelse om at drift, kriseledelse og annet kritisk personell må flyttes til et annet sted. Forsvaret skal sikre bygget og gjøre situasjonen tryggere for Telenor og Telenors produksjon. Det er imidlertid ikke bare en fysisk trussel som har materialisert seg. I Cyberdawn har Telenor måttet be politiet om støtte på grunn av angrep mot samfunnskritisk infrastruktur. Politiet har vendt seg mot Forsvaret, og Forsvarets operative hovedkvarter har gitt Cyberforsvaret ordre om å bistå Telenor i cyberspace. En nasjonal krise også i det digitale rom er et faktum.
Prøv å tenke seg, hva har vi egentlig lært av Cyberdawn?
Det viktigste lærdommen jeg sitter igjen med er at et angrep i cyberspace på kritisk infrastruktur i Norge må i fellesskap løses av myndigheter og aktører. Det vil si de som var med i denne øvelsen er helt sentrale, og sammen er vi sterke, og sammen har vi god kompetanse.
Combined with also more physical exercise, so it's not only a cyber exercise. We saw that they actually did train or exercise to move from their offices at Telenor to an alternative location because of things that they were doing exercise. I participated in it, and I think that the most valuable lesson that we got in this exercise was that we needed to have even more focus on information sharing and collaboration between the different teams that were involved in common incidents. Okay, I think I can go through some more content before we take a coffee break in 5 minutes. Okay, are you awake? Yeah. So, these are things that you should think about when you prepare for doing the same response. You should have some communication facilities. It's very important to have lists of contact information of who you typically collaborate with when you perform the same response. Also, on-call information, have a list of how to get contact your own personnel to get in more people in case something big happens. Incident reporting mechanisms and issue tracking systems can often be, you can use things like ticket systems just to keep track of all the different incidents, but there are also tools that are specially made for incident response.
tickets in the typical IT support system, or like a typical issue tracking system. You might need to hand out dedicated smartphones to your incident handlers that are on call, so that they can get, so you can easily get hold of them, and they might also contain some tools that allow them to work remotely if needed. Of course, it's important to prepare also facilities, like you might need a war room if you don't have a dedicated space for your incident response team. You might need to set up a space where you can sit together and work on incidents. And so also look into different ways of securing your own operations, like encrypting your files and how to store them securely. There's a lot of hardware and software that you need to prepare before responding to an incident. I'm not going to go through all these lists, but it's a lot of things that you should have actually purchased and have in your team beforehand. And also, it could be good to have a go bag. It means you have a kit that you can bring along if you need to move to another location to do incident response. That has like already set up laptops with the tools that you typically use, and all the different network adapters and things that you might find handy when you're investigating an incident. And of course, it depends on your team, if it's a mobile team or not. You do go out to clients or to other offices to do that. Also, look into preparing different resources that will become handy when you do incident response. Typically, it's very good to have as thorough as possible documentation of your network. It means that you have already a good overview of what's the normal things that are going on in your network. Lists of ports that you can use, like firewall rules lists, network diagrams, list of all your critical assets, and what are like the expected way that the system behaves. Because this can then be used in case something goes on to easily single out what is the suspicious activity or suspicious traffic. Also, you could have cryptographic hashes of your critical files, so that would allow you to see if any very critical files have been modified or tampered with in any way. Typically, this could be log files, because that could be that's a very common thing that intruders in the internet do, is that they delete things in the log files in order to hide the traffic. So to keep an eye on if any log files have been maliciously modified, could be a good thing. Also, access to clean operation system images or application installations and ways to recover from backups and so on is very important. And then preparing for all the coordination and communication. So this is an example of who you might need to be prepared to coordinate or communicate with in an incident. And that could typically be your customers, the people that you serve, your constituents, the media, other incident response teams, your internet service provider, your incident reporters, in case someone reports an incident to you that is not part of your organization. That could also be include law enforcement agencies. So FBI is knocking on the door and telling you have been compromised. Then you need to
be prepared to have a conversation with them, or in Norway, the Secret Service police, for instance. Software and support vendors, and all of your, let's say, contractors and vendors are also very important to have relationships with. So not only have their contact list and the contact information, but try to actually maintain a relationship with some of these actors, meet them, and have beers with them. So that's also part of this responsible preparation, I would say. Then it's a bit more fun. So with that, we'll take a 15-minute break, and then we continue talking about information sharing and how to coordinate.
Okay, you're back from the coffee break and ready for another 45 minutes of lectures, right?
Yeah.
So as I was answering some questions about your project work in the break, if you have questions, please ask them in the next break or the last break, because I will have to leave straight after the last lecture to get to the airport. So I will be hurrying out of here at 2 o'clock. Okay, so back to coordination and communication, which is a really big part of incident response. How do you do information sharing? It's crucial in order to coordinate your team's incident handling across the constituencies, but also very often when you have an incident, it's not an isolated case. Very often there are other victims of the same threat, or you need to communicate with other parties. You might want to do the community a service by gathering information about your event, your incident, and sharing it with other teams so that they can be proactive and maybe detect the same things going on in their constituency or their organization. That's one thing. You might want to notify others by creating reports on incidents. And this can also be done using tools in an automated way. And that's the alert and advisory distribution and sharing of indicators of compromise. And there are already established a number of different groups that do this type of information sharing. There are open and also closed membership mailing lists and forums where information is shared. You have membership organizations, like for instance FIRST. TFC CERT is another organization which is for focused more on European members. And you have the collaboration between countries, like bilateral or multilateral information sharing agreements. And some of this information sharing is done in like open communities, open forums and lists. And some is in closed list, and some is even done in a on a classified level between intelligence agencies. So there's a lot of information sharing going on, and often it's not a lot of information to get about how this information sharing is performed. In Norway, we have a situation where there are different CERT teams for different sectorial that have like different sectorial responsibilities, and the national CERT, North CERT, is sort of the hub of these different teams. And once when incidents happen, of course, information about this should be distributed to different relevant recipients in the different sectors and different organizations. And this could be done in a hierarchical manner. It's not as simple as like a perfect hierarchy. It doesn't really work like that. It's more like a network. So that's why it's illustrated by these three branches. So even though different sectorial teams have different members in different sectors, some of these are also members of NorCERT. So there are direct communication lines from NorCERT to the different organizations, and there's also communication to the sectorial CERT. So they get information, threat intelligence, from all these different teams. I don't know if you've heard about all of these teams. Actually, I haven't updated this figure with all the latest additions, There's also now a telecom sector search in the communication authority. I think the longest living cert of this is the Uninet cert, which is actually the cert responsible for you, all the universities and the education networks. They were the first established cert team in Norway, so they have a long history of doing incident response. And then we have the Cyberforsvaret, or the military cert team, because that's actually kind of connected to this area. We have the Kraftcert, which is for the energy sector in Norway. We have Helsecert, which is part of Helsenet. That's the network provider for all the hospitals and all the doctors' offices and so on in Norway. Also, some of the municipalities use a lot of the services. And Justice CCERT is for the police networks. And Finance CERT is created by the banks and is focusing a lot on information sharing about banking trojans and malware. Any questions about how we do information sharing in Norway? Just remember that it's a big part of incident response to share information. And how do you share information? I mentioned briefly that there's something called a traffic light protocol. And this is a way of sharing information that can be a bit sensitive in nature, and at the same time try to keep in control of how this information is spread. Like typically, if you share information with your friend, telling your friend some secrets or whatever, sometimes it's hard to know if you can trust that person to not tell everyone else. And then suddenly you hear this information from someone that were like totally unrelated to where you shared this in the first place. And that's what we try to prevent in this trust environment. So remember that information sharing and communication is a lot to do with trust. You don't want to share information with someone that you're not trusting to be responsible in treating that information in the way it should be treated. And it's particularly important when you're doing incident response and you're sort of fighting the cyber criminals. Of course, the cyber criminals share information among themselves, and as responders, we also need to do the same thing in order to be prepared to handle the incidents. But it's very important that this information doesn't leak out, and then the cyber criminals or your threat actors, if they get information about what you're doing to protect yourself against them, it will of course make your job harder as an incident responder. So some of this information need to be in closed groups. So just go through this way of sharing information. So typically you will, with the organization that you're sharing information, you could have an agreement or a contract where they sign off that they are adhering to the traffic light protocol in their way of treating this information. So white, that's not really a traffic light color, but that means if information is TLP white, you can share it as you want. So you can put it on your website, you can share it with everyone. So it's not really a restricted way of sharing information. Green means you should only share with the parties that are within the broader community or sector. So it means you're not sharing this with everyone,
but you're sharing it with everyone that's within the incident response community, for instance. So you can send this on a mailing list, and then all the members of this mailing list will get this information, and they can share it with everyone else in the same community. Typically, amber is the color that is mostly used in order to restrict information. When you mark something with the TLP amber, you will trust that whoever receives this information only shares it with members of their own organization on a need-to-know basis, and only as widely as necessary to act on the information. So this is typically lists of could be lists of IP addresses that participate in an attack. So this is information that is crucial for all the network administrators that need to block this information, block this attack, or need to look into the logs to see if they have been hit by the same thing, for instance. You should not spread this information out so that the attackers get hold of it, for instance. So the definition of TLP has been a little bit debated and changed in recent years. And TLP Amber used to say that you only share it within your organization, but then contractors and customers were also included in this, because a lot of these teams, they need to share this information with their clients and with the customers in order for them to also stop attacks. Then you have the most restrictive color of the TLP protocol, which is red. And that's a bit difficult to use, because if you receive TLP red information, this means that it's only you as a named person, individual, that can use this information. And that's actually, in a lot of cases, not very useful when you're trying to act on information. It does say that recipients may not share TLP red information with any parties outside the specific exchange, meeting, or conversation in which it is originally disclosed. So you can share this in a meeting. That means that all the meeting participants, they can't really use this information outside of the meeting or share it with anyone else that didn't participate in the meeting. If you want to share information, you should contact the source of the information and ask for permission to share. And then typically you will provide them with a list of people that you need to share this with, and you need to get their consent in order to share it further on. Like in practice, the way we use TLP when I worked with incident response myself was to put it in the header of emails, put them the top and the bottom of the emails that were sent out. We could also, in an exchange where we talk to people, say, this information is TLP amber, and then give the information in a dialogue. Or we could mark notifications and alerts that were sent out with this information. Any questions to TLP? It's a very useful way of doing information sharing and keeping clear how the information can be acted upon. So I want to introduce or briefly mention a platform that is used by a lot of incident responders right now. It's called the MISP Threat Sharing Platform. And this is a tool that is used to share information, like for instance indicators of compromise or IOCs. And it's automated. So you don't have to send out a lot of emails or call someone or have meetings to share information. You can just log into the MISP platform. You can enter the details that you found in your investigation of an incident. And then this will be automatically shared with the participants that are also in this threat sharing, threat
intelligence sharing platform. You can just look into MISP project.org to get more information about MISP. It's a very useful tool and it's become quite popular. And information related to threat can come in different formats. And this tool has an API that supports a lot of different ways of formatting the information about the threats. I'll give you a practical example of MISP in the next seminar when I go into some instance use cases in detail. Okay, so now I'll switch context a little bit and talk about how you build a security incident response team. Before you start your incident handling and your incident planning, you need to have someone in place that can actually perform the incident response. So before you start making a team, you need to have some information in place that you collect typically from your stakeholders. You identify the need you have. Then you decide on what type of structure you want for your team. And then you start to determine what are the services that your team is giving. First you need to name the team, of course. And this I created this list because I got a lot of questions, confusion from students about what does CERT or CCERT mean. And there are so many different acronyms, abbreviations of sort of same thing. And the reason for this is that CERT is a trademark, has been trademarked, so you cannot name your team CERT unless you get approval from Carnegie Mellon CERT CC. So you actually have to apply to CERT CC to ask, can I call my team something, something CERT? And I guess that's part of the reason why we have all the other ways of naming the same thing. So incident response team, IRT, is the same as a CERT. This one is used a lot, CCERT, and it's computer security incident response team. Some teams are called CERT, computer incident response team. And then you have computer incident response capability or center. Security incident response team, and so on. What is a bit different here is the SOC and the NOC. So SOC, that is the security operations center. That's it can be part of your CERT team, but it's like where you have operators monitoring what's going on and looking to find, for instance, monitoring all your intrusion detection system alerts. And they're sort of in this SOC center. NOC is a network operation center. Sometimes this can be the same team, depending on the size of the organization, or the SOC can be a smaller part of the NOC. But network operation center is typically where you keep track of your network status at all times, and you have people working on responding to network outages that are not usually caused by security incidents. Okay. And then there are other abbreviations that are not the same as CERT, but that are somehow these can perform some of the tasks that a CERT do, or they are very often in close relation or collaborating a lot with the CERT. One is the ISAC or the ISAL, that's the Information Sharing Analysis Center or Information Sharing Analysis Organization. That's typically a CERT, or it's typically a team that performs only the information sharing part of the CERT. So they're not doing incident response, they're just collecting and sharing information about incidents and about threats. MSSP, that is a service provider that can offer some of the services that a CERT does.
And often a cert can outsource some of its tasks to an MSSP. That's a consultancy that might offer services for several companies. And you have other managed service providers, and the last one, emergency response services. That's typically not to do with computer security, but other emergencies. Okay, so you got all these abbreviations on this slide in case you get confused about this. So what are the recommended steps when you start building a cert team? Of course, the first thing is to obtain management support and buy-in. We've been through this before. That's really crucial. And that also means you get a budget. And then you set the strategic plan, you gather the information you need, you design a vision, and you communicate this, and you start implementing your CSERT or CERT. And then you announce that you have an operational CSERT once it's in place. And then the last step is to try to evaluate its effectiveness. And this can be done in different ways, but it's a kind of a research topic actually to have good enough measures and metrics in order to evaluate this. But there are different things that you can measure. So step one, management support and buy-in. It's so important because if you don't have this, you will most likely fail in setting up a certain. You most likely won't get the funding you need to buy the tools and manage the services that you need. And you need this all the time, and you need to have some top level management that is feel ownership of the search. The CEO, the Chief Information Officer, could be someone that is naturally management person that could be the functional owner of a CSERT. It could also be the CISO, the Security Information Security Officer, or it could be someone else, you know, like the Chief Operational Officer. The next thing, determine a strategic plan. Set a time frame. How long do you have to from start to finish to develop the search. Find out if you need to hire people. Maybe you can use some of the personnel you already have. Find the gap skills. Find out what type of positions you should hire if you need to hire someone. Depending of course on your needs, you should have a team model and structure that fits your need. We'll get back to that. Figure out what is needed funding, and then the training and testing methods. Look at your communication requirements and how you can do this, how you can fit this into the organization in a good way. Also identify the responsible persons. And of course, it's a good thing if the person in charge of IT security, the person in charge of IT, and the CSERT manager, that they go well together and that they can communicate. And then look at the different procedures and how to update or modify your documenting activities, and decide on some training and testing methods. So what skills are needed in a CSERT? I would like to have some interaction today, so can anyone figure out what you need to have as a skill in order to work in a team? Just make a guess if you can tell me. Yeah? Administration? Yeah? So you need to have someone in the team that can handle all the different administrative tasks, that's right. Any more incident response related? What type of persons do you think typically do these anti-spots? What kind of personal skills do they have? Social skills that I've been saying over and over again. Communication. It's really, really important to have some communication skills. But at the same time, you need to have technical, analytical skills. Sometimes it's hard to find a person that has both of this. But depending on the team size, you can have some people that focus on communication and some that focus on technical analytic tasks. So they're both needed. High stress tolerance, I already mentioned. Okay, there's a long list. So this is just, it's not an exhausting list, but you need to have a super person, superwoman, superman, in order to find someone with all these skills. So that's why you need to have a diverse and team. So try to hire people that fill different roles, because you can't find one person that has all of this. That's impossible. Okay. But a lot of the things that you learn here is very relevant to working in incident response. I hope some of you consider a career in incident response. So system administration, network administration, firewall administration, intrusion detection, cryptography, data storage and recovery, malware analysis, forensic analysis, scripting and coding, documentation creation and maintenance, creating following policy and plans, teamwork skills, communication skills, writing skills, speaking skills. So all of this is needed. So maybe you find one or two of these that you think, I'm good at that. And then you can specialize in that area. And of course, social skills or interpersonal skills. That's also a lot of different things. So I also created a long list of this. I'd say the most important thing is, you need to have common sense to make efficient and acceptable decisions whenever there is no clear ruling available and under stress and severe time constraints. Maybe that doesn't sound like the dream job, but for some people it's a very fun or job with a lot of action. There's lots of things going on that's really exciting, and it's almost like being in a James Bond movie at times. But it's in cyber, so it's you don't have to have all the physical skills. You don't have to look like a superman or superwoman. But you can actually have a lot of fun. If you like action. So effective oral and written communication skills, because we need to interact with each other when we do incident response. Diplomacy, that's also very important. Dealing with other partners, dealing with media, dealing with the victim. So try to imagine that you are the person picking up the phone, calling someone and telling them that all of your databases are on the internet. They are on WikiLeaks or on some other leak site. That's not a good that's not a good message to get if you're a company and you're in charge maybe of keeping your databases secure. And all they're on Pastebin. All your user credentials are on Pastebin. And you're the person telling this to the IT administration. You need to have some conflict resolving, some special skills in diplomacy. And also maybe talking to the media requires that. Team player, being a bit creative and finding new ways of addressing new situations that occur, but at the same time being able to follow procedures and policies, which is a kind of conflict sometimes. And of course, time management. Concentrate on priority work. These are some examples of the roles you can have. So as I said, you don't need to have all the different skills in one person. You will
typically have different roles in the team that different persons will fulfill. And these were the roles that we did kind of roughly at Mercer. We had one incident handler officer that was a team leader, and team leader of the week in charge of all the incidents that were happening that week. Then we had analysts that were doing the malware analysis and other like network analysis and so on, working on the more technical parts of the incident handling. We had also a role called watch officer, and that was the person that was in charge of keeping track of all that was happening in the, for instance, just monitoring a lot of Twitter accounts and trying to catch new information about new vulnerabilities, reading blogs, and just paying attention to whatever is going on in the media. Getting hold of that information as quickly as possible, and creating reports, and putting it into briefs and so on. So very different types of roles, and filled with different types of skills, people with different skills. Okay, so you have different roles in the team, but you could also organize the team in different ways. And these are some examples of team models. This is also covered in the course textbook, so you can read about them there. So I'm not going to go into too much detail. What's important to separate between is if you have your own employees in the C-sort, if you have it partially outsourced, or if you have it fully outsourced. That's three different ways of this. Organizing team. You could have a security team, that's kind of the minimum team you could have. You could have as a C-sort or certain. It's not really a C-sort, it's just someone that is dedicated to look into security, and maybe part of your IT administration team. You could have a C-sort that is distributed, that is centralized, that is combined, distributed and centralized, or you could have another type of team, which is coordinating C-cert. Coordinating C-cert is typically a C-cert that has other C-certs or other teams below it in the hierarchy that is reporting to. So it's more of an information sharing hub than the actual people that are doing the incident response on site. So the security team model is where you use the existing IT staff in an ad hoc C-cert, maybe only when big incidents happen. So typically for a smaller company that doesn't need to have a team 24/7 or all the time ready to work on incidents. Could also be part-time people working on the security team. So there's no real organizational structure. It's just a small team that is doing security incidents. You could have a distributed C-cert. That means that you have a team composed of staff from other divisions or sectors of the enterprise to report to a central C-cert manager. This can be found in large and distributed organizations such as multinational corporations. And it's a lot of ways of organizing it. But in all of them you have a main function of the C-cert manager that is to coordinate the work of the distributed C-cert, and they should therefore be located close to the management. Centralized C-cert is a model that can be used by actually two very different types of organization. It's most commonly found in small organizations where the number of staff, systems and buildings can be handled by a small centralized IT department and the C-cert that is part of the central IT department. But it can also be used in larger organizations that have a constituency that is over many countries, like physical and geographical locations. then you can combine these two models into a combined distributed and centralized research, where you have this is the best suited for very large distributed organizations, and you don't need this model usually in a very small organization. So here you have different functional business units that has distributed team members, and they all report to a centralized research where you have a full team that is also doing the same response. And then it's the coordinating research model, where the main focus is on coordinating, facilitating incident and vulnerability handling activities. And this is typically the way a national research or CERT operates. So here you have, you could have the national CERT, and then you could compare this to the model I showed for Norway, where we had no CERT as the big coordinating CERT team, and you had sectorial CERT that it will distribute information to. Or you could have this in a very large organization where you have lots of different functional business units that have their own CERT teams too. Okay, so how do you select your CERT structure and your team model? It's of course depending on the size and your distribution of your constituency. You remember what the word constituency means? It's the members that are part of your organization that are using the CERT services. It's depending on what type of services you provide. And also, of course, funding and resources and position in the organization. And these are some things that you should ask yourself when you select your structure and team model. Do you need to be 24/7 available? Do we have enough budget and resources to have full-time members, or do we only need to have, or can we only have part-time members of the team? How do you best organize the employees? How is the employee morale in your company? Will they work on their own, or do they need that? Can they work with home offices, or do you need to have them in a central team? Also, of course, look at the cost and your other organizational structure, how it fits into your organizational shop. And then look into whether or not you're outsourcing parts of the incident response services. So outsourcing the CERT. There are a lot of advantages, of course, to outsource CERT or some of the CERT services. It means that you will have some professional incident response staff that do the services. So if you're a small company that can only afford to have people working part-time on a security team, maybe it's better to outsource, because then you will get people that are working on incident response all the time. Typically, they can offer 24/7 monitoring, like a managed service provider would do that. You will get early notification of potential problems, because they might typically see things that other customers that they can also look for in your organization. An outsourced CERT can have a lot of good equipment and well-trained staff, so you don't need to invest in additional personal costs or training. But what are the disadvantages of outsourcing the CERT? Of course, you cannot only have benefits by doing it. You will lose some control when it comes to responding to incidents. You have to rely on another service provider to do some of the incident response for you. Sometimes, depending on the nature of your business, you might have a lot of confidential information that you are a bit reluctant to share with service providers or consultants. And so if you do outsource, you need to potentially expose this information.
you might get locked into their services and like proprietary equipment, so you're not free to choose what type of tools you're using. You always have to keep in mind that the contract can, when the contract expires, how do you continue? What is the continuity of doing this? And you might lose a lot of services that are hard to replicate or that you can't get from other service providers. So then you get kind of locked in. And also, they will typically offer products that are not always tailor-made for every of their customers. So you have to sort of fit into their customization. And maybe, let's say that a big incident happens that hit all their customers and clients at once. Will you be their biggest, most important client and the one they first look at? That's something you should keep in mind when you outsource. Okay. So when you have decided on whether or not to outsource or not, what type of organizational model, you should design a C-suite vision. What does this mean? You should identify who are you giving your C-suite services to, who are you supporting and serving. What should be your mission, goal, and objectives? And then select the services that you want to provide to your constituents, identify your resources, and determine your funding. So what are the services that C-certs usually offer? Of course, incident response, that's kind of clear. That should be one of the services if you're an incident response team. And this is the core component. I think we've been through what incident response is by now. But there are also a lot of proactive services that the team could provide. Help to prepare, protect, and secure your systems. And this could actually reduce the number of incidents in the future. Also, security quality management services. Could be part of the portfolio. It means that the team can come in, review, use its expertise in other areas than incident response, because you might have very well qualified personnel in this team that could help with implementing new security features, give training, assist in risk assessments, and so on. This is generally proactive, but doesn't really always reduce the number of incidents. And this is an overview of different types of services sorted in the three categories: reactive, proactive, and security quality management. And here you can see where different CERT team services fits in. So typically a CERT team or C-CERT team won't offer all of these. They will have a portfolio on what are we offering. And some of this can also be like outsourced. So I'll go through some of the most common and important services that C-CERT teams does. One is reactive services, means alerts and warnings. This is disseminating information that describes an attack, describes a vulnerability, way of identifying whether you've been hit by a virus or a malware campaign. And also usually there's a short description of course of action, how to deal with this problem. So this is something we did a lot in NorCERT. This is one example of such an advisory. There was a new vulnerability in the Linux library, and it was very important to do some workarounds in this case, because there were no security office available when this vulnerability was known. So in that case, we would write a short notice and send out the email to our partners that were on a different emailing list, and also put the notice on the website.
This is a typical circle. We're just doing technology watch, figuring out what's new vulnerabilities that we need to protect ourselves against, and then give an alert and a notification to our customers. And then it's the reactive services, and that's what happens after an incident takes place. And that's receiving information about the potential incident, doing the triage, and responding to requests and reports and analyzing the incidents. And this could be that you need to do something to stop attacks, like for instance shutting down some ports in your firewall or whatever. Maybe also shutting down services or taking part of the system offline in worst case. To look for activity, look into your network traffic, maybe filter out some network traffic if you're under DDoS attack. Rebuild systems that have been infected. So like you can identify all the clients that have been affected with a certain type of malware. You typically take them offline, clean them, and reinstall them and put them online again. And then hopefully you have patched everything that made this malware or virus be able to affect your systems in the first place. And also looking into ways of responding or doing workarounds to new threats. So incident analysis is a very important part of doing incident response. The purpose of this is to identify what actually happened in the incident, what is the scope, how much damage has been caused, and how to respond to it. So you need to have some artifacts or some evidence to examine in order to figure out what is going on. And that's typically done by evidence collection, and then trying to track and trace and figuring out how the intruders got into your system, how you got infected, what caused this DDoS attack, how did they get into your system. And you can do this on your own, but usually you will have to engage other parties, like law enforcement personnel or internet service providers or other organizations that are also involved in the same incident. You can respond to an incident better if you have more information about what's going on in the incident. Okay, I see I'm running out of time. We are already over 12 o'clock. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't pay attention to the clock. So we have like 12 minutes to change to the other room. But I'll give you a couple of minutes more, so we have a break in 15 minutes, and then I'll continue talking about incident response in the other room. Okay. So see you in K105.